All right, 1 Samuel chapter 21. We're picking up here at an interesting place. David is on the run from Saul, who is trying to kill him. David has just fled from the town of Ramah, which is nearby. There he saw his best friend, who is Jonathan. And Jonathan confirmed for him Saul's intentions. Saul does in fact desire to kill David. Jonathan also provides the means of escape, and David is on his way. Picking up in verse 1, chapter 21, it says, "Then David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech came trembling to meet David and said to him, 'Why are you alone and no one with you?' David said to Ahimelech the priest, 'The king has commissioned me with a matter that and has said to me, no one is to know anything about the matter on which I am sending you, and with which I have commissioned you. And I have directed the young men to a certain place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found.' The priest answered David and said, 'There is no ordinary bread on hand, but there is consecrated bread, if only the young men have kept themselves from women.' David answered the priest and said to him, 'Be assured, women have been denied to us, as previously when I left. The bodies of the young men are consecrated, though it was an ordinary journey. How much more then will their bodies be consecrated today?' So the priest gave him consecrated bread, for there was no bread there except the bread of the presence, which was removed from its place before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place on the day that it was taken away. Now one of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg, the Edomite, chief of Saul's shepherds." Pause there. First this morning, we will see that fear is an opportunity to seek him. Fear is an opportunity to seek him. David has fled from the presence of Saul in fear for his life. Saul has already tried to kill him on 3 separate occasions now. And he goes to this place called Nob. Now, in that time, Nob would be basically the priestly city. So this is where the tabernacle was. This is where the high priest was. This is where all of those things happened. If you wanted to do something that required going to the Lord, this would be the place to go. If you're trying to offer a sacrifice or inquire after the Lord's servants, like see if they have any counsel from God, this is the place you go. We meet this priest. His name is Ahimelech, presumably the high priest. It says Ahimelech comes, he comes, and it says he came trembling to meet David. Trembling to meet David. It is possible that news of Saul's intention to kill David has already reached the priests. Now, I'm not certain if that's why he's trembling. It could just be David's a pretty important guy. It's, you know, he's chief among Saul's servants. He's like second in his house. Pretty important guy. There's a lot going on. And he says, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" Because it would be weird. David, a guy this important, is traveling all by himself. There's no retinue or anything like that. What we expect to see from David, what we expect up to this point, all we've seen from David is he's faithful. He's a good servant. But he does something that's a bit out of character here, a bit unusual. David decides to lie. David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king has commissioned me with a matter and has said to me, 'No one is to know anything about the matter on which I am sending you and with which I have commissioned you.'" If we read the previous chapter, we know that David is running for his life. The king who supposedly commissioned him with a matter, that didn't happen at all. It's possible Ahimelech knows David is lying at this point. It's possible the news has reached him. If so, then helping David would be incredibly risky. helping David would be to defy the king. And from what we've learned about Saul to this point, Saul is not exactly the most well-tempered guy. David explains away his lack of provisions. He explains why there's nobody with him on this apparently pretty important journey. It's interesting, it's actually unclear whether or not there were other people with him. Based on the rest of the passage, probably not. But there's also not really any way to know. Maybe he had people with him, maybe he didn't. I think regardless, he takes the bread. Now, the showbread, or consecrated bread, or bread of the presence, it has a lot of different names depending on your translation. Essentially, this is the bread that is placed before the Lord as kind of an offering. And the idea is that only the priests eat the consecrated bread. They're the only ones that can touch it, and only after hot bread has taken its place. But interestingly, the priest gives this bread to David. Now, there's a couple things he requires. He asks, like, have women been kept from you? That's all part of, like, the ceremonial, Old Testament Levitical law. It's ritual cleanliness, basically. But the other part of it, the part of it where only a priest can eat it, Ahimelech decides to disregard that one. We actually find out that he rightly overlooks this part of ceremony in order to provide for David's needs. I say that because of Matthew 12, verses 3 through 4, which I won't get into it, but Jesus endorses this act. The idea here is that Ahimelech is overlooking certain parts of legalism in order to show mercy. This is a good indicator of where Ahimelech's heart is. He's focused on kindness. He's focused on providing for David. We'll come to find out in the next chapter, Ahimelech is a pretty good guy. He's a pretty dedicated servant of the Lord. And David has the right idea in fleeing to the temple of the Lord. I mean, that's the place you should go if you're in trouble. Go to the house of God, seek his servants out. However, David only gets it half right. He goes to the right place, but he doesn't do the right things. He rightly seeks out the priests. We quickly see his heart isn't really in the proper place. Overcome with his fear, David lies to Ahimelech. And what we hope to see, what we expect to see from David, is we expect David to take this to God. We expect David to go to Ahimelech and beg him to go to the Lord on his behalf. We want to see David say to God, Father, I don't know how you're going to do this. I don't know how you're going to save me, but I know you can. Why does he know this? Because the Lord's already done that for David. Instead, David is ruled by his fear, and we see deception from him. We see just a plain, flat-out lie. And not just lying, it's lying to a priest of the Lord. All of this raises the question as to whether or not David's lying in this passage is in fact sinful. I think if I were to ask the question, is lying wrong, basically everybody would say yes. Are there ever cases, though, in which it is excusable? Two biblical accounts that I can think of where you could make the case that lying is not punished, maybe even blessed. I'm not going to go there, but Exodus 1, 15 through 21, if you want to jot it down, and Joshua chapter 2, 1 through 7. Both of these events, the lies told, are matters of life and death. One is the Hebrew midwives, When Pharaoh asks them to kill the baby boys, and they lie, and they save the boys' lives. The other is Rahab, who hides the spies from the Israelites in Jericho, and she lies to the men of Jericho, and the spies' lives are saved. Both of these cases, life and death, danger is immediate. Maybe you could find some ground to defend those lies biblically. Also consider it's probably more so the result of the lie, not so much the lie itself that's blessed. I think you would be hard-pressed to find solid grounds to argue that lying is excusable in general. You could look up 30 verses or more, and you would all find pretty harsh, pretty clear things to say about lying. I think, regardless, these are very much standalone examples. Again, be hard to find more like this. But I think what we see in our passage, and I think if we take a biblical perspective of lying, and we look at the passage, what we see is David lying repeatedly. Right? David's situation right now, the danger, not really immediate, and the consequences, not really dire. What I don't see from David is him doing something, him telling a lie to preserve the life of somebody else, or because there seems to be no alternative. What I see is David, kind of hungry, not having a sword, and so on, and so he lies. What we see from David in this passage is a repeated lack of trust in the Lord. Understand, this does not appear to be outright conscious rebellion. Like, David doesn't put up his walls against the Lord. He's not actively denying God. No, he's acting out of fear. He's terrified. He's scared for his life. And in his fear, he acts in a sinful manner that normally would be out of the question for him. He acts in a manner that's completely out of character for David. But I think we can sympathize with David a little bit here. See, it's easy to get a 10,000-foot view, look at the passage thousands of years later, and pick on David because he did some stuff wrong. But if you really look at it, if you really look at his situation, it's, man, would I really do any different? David is on the run. His own father-in-law, the father of his closest friend, the king of his people, and beyond that, a man that David loves dearly, is determined by any means necessary, to kill him. We see that he bends all the resources of Israel to killing David. He tries multiple times to ambush him, to trap him. Tries to have him assassinated. I've never had a king try to kill me. I've never had anyone that close to me try to hunt me down. I look at David, and I kind of think, man, I'd probably kind of do the same thing. David's motivator here is fear. It's anxiety. It's not pride. He's not telling lies because he's envious of what Ahimelech has. He's not telling lies because he's too prideful to tell him he's running from the king. No, he's afraid. It's none of the things you would typically imagine as a prelude to sin. It's at this point in time that David, what we want for David is we want him to go to God with this. We want him to go before the Lord. This should be an opportunity. Instead, he resorts to his own means. We kind of do that. I do that. I resort to my own means. What are you running from? David's running from Saul. We know that. He's running from death. But there's a lot of things we run from. A lot of things I run from. What is that thing that keeps you up at night? What anxieties weigh heavy on your mind throughout the day? When was the last time I came to worship, found my attention divided by some worry, by some trouble? When have I gone to the Lord and found that I'm only half confident in His plan? That I only half trust in His provision? Where does my fear rule me? In one of his most famous works, the author C.S. Lewis writes in the Screwtape Letters, he writes about the past, the present, fear, and love. He writes in the context of eternity, wherein we live in the present, and where the Lord wants us to dwell is the present, because in the present we can best experience His love for us right now. He also praises looking to the past as a means to remember what He's already done for us. In this book, there's a senior tempter writing to his nephew, which is the premise. Essentially devils having correspondence. And he writes about the way they should direct the humans to forget about what he's done, forget about what he's doing right now, and think about what is to come. He says, gratitude looks to the past. Love looks to the present. Fear, avarice, lust, and ambition look ahead. How often have I forgotten what He has done for me because I'm too busy fixating on what's going to happen tomorrow? How often do I miss the opportunity to grow close with Him because I'm too fixated on what I'm afraid of 2 months from now? You see, I fixate on the future and its troubles. Man, we all kind of do that. Whether it's work, relationships, money, sin. I could go on. What keeps you from looking back at what He has done for you, and what stops you from resting in the fullness of His love right now? Think for a second if our lives were a story and somebody could read it. How often would the reader of that book flip through and be like, dude, kind of slap their foreheads and be like, just go to God. Like, that's worked every other time. Why are you not doing that now? And that's how we feel about David right now. We see, however, that even now the Lord uses Ahimelech to provide David with the things he needs. David gets the bread. He gets the food he needs. Despite his lack of trust. Despite the fact that he walks into a temple and talks to a priest and just flat out lies, the Lord provides for him. Let me see verse 7. Now one of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg, the Edomite, the chief of Saul's shepherds. This verse appears out of place. It's kind of ominous, and it should be. It's a foreshadowing of what will happen in the next passage. tragically, Saul will arrive and he will hear that Ahimelech helped David. He will hear because of Doeg, this man, chief of Saul's shepherds, tells him. Saul will order Doeg to kill every priest, including Ahimelech and all of his sons, and every man, woman, and child in the city of Nob. It's clear from chapter 22 that David at least suspected this fact. Chapter 22, verse 22, it says, "Then David said to Abiathar," who was Ahimelech's son, "I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would certainly tell Saul, I myself have turned against every person in your father's household." David arriving at the temple causes the death of every single one of the priests, including Ahimelech. There's one man who survives. That's his son. No, I don't know if David telling the truth changes anything. I don't know if David was honest that all those priests would have survived. I can't say that. What I can say is it certainly doesn't make anything any worse. It wouldn't change anything for the worse, and guess what? Based on what we know about Ahimelech, he probably would have helped David anyway. They would have understood the danger coming to them. Chapter 22, verse 14 says, "Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, among all your servants is as faithful as David, even the king's son-in-law, who is captain over your guard and is honored in your house?" He says, "Did I just begin to inquire of God for him today? Far be it from me." Apparently, Ahimelech has been going to the Lord on David's behalf for some time now. This is a man who would have helped, who was faithful, who has a heart that serves the Lord. And David deceives him. See, David's trust isn't really in the Lord here, is it? Seems divided. In fact, we will not one time in this passage actually see David go to God. What we see is a pattern of distrust between David, a pattern of fear, David kind of just trusting himself. Verses 8 through 9, "David said to Ahimelech, 'Now, is there no spear or sword on hand? For I brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's matter was urgent.' Then the priest said, 'The sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, behold, it is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you would take it for yourself, take it, for there is no other except it here.' And David said, 'There is none like it. Give it to me.'" David tells a second lie, which explains his lack of a weapon. He's like, "The king sent me on this super important mission that really needed to get done, but I had to leave right away, so I didn't grab anything. Didn't grab my spear, my sword, any of that." Interestingly enough, the only weapon on hand is the sword of Goliath, the giant who David killed three chapters ago. Four. It's actually a huge stroke of luck that there's a sword there at all, because temples were not exactly known for having a bunch of weapons in them. It is significant that there's a sword there, and it is significant that it is the sword of Goliath. David takes the sword as a means to defend himself from Saul's men. We know from previous chapters that David is a mighty warrior. Whenever he goes out against a foe, he prevails. We see Saul, even in an attempt to kill David, sends him up, and he's like, if you want to marry my daughter, you kill 100 Philistines. David goes out and he kills 200. But we know the true reason for David's success has never been his own might. It's never been his own skill. Chapter 18, verse 14. David was prospering in all of his ways, for the Lord was with him. David has not so far backed down from a foe, never run from a fight, because the Lord is with him. This is the boy who stood up against lions, giants, and bears. Oh my. This is the boy who went out to fight in numerous battles and was never afraid. I think we know that those battles don't belong to David. David knew that too. In fact, he freely admits it. Chapter 17, verse 45 says, "You come to me," this is him speaking to Goliath, "you come to me with a sword, spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord God of hosts." You read that and you're like, that is so cool. Like, this is a boy. This is a boy with a stick and a sling standing up against this giant. And he can say that. He has the courage and the trust to say that. Where is that now? Where did that go? This is a boy that stood fearless against anything. Not because he knew he was stronger or more skilled or better, but because he knew the Lord of hosts was behind him. He now finds the sword of Goliath and he says, "There is none like it. Give it to me." It's at this point you just have to ask, what is he actually trusting in? So far, we know he has not gone to the Lord. He's not even asked Ahimelech to go to the Lord for him. Though we find out the priest actually does go to the Lord on David's behalf. But that's at no request of David's. David does not seem overly trusting. And when you really think about it, the sword of Goliath, I mean, come on. Didn't you, like, kill that guy, like, 15 seconds after you, like, the Lord does not deliver with sword and spear and all that? And it's like, and now you're here, and you're like, I have to have a sword. I need this thing. This is a reminder. This is a reminder of what the Lord has done for him. The reminder of the victories that God has achieved on David's behalf. And it's totally lost on him. It is completely wasted on him. His response in verse 9, "There is none like it. Give it to me." That doesn't show me he really is thinking too hard about whether or not he actually needs this thing, whether or not this thing's actually going to save him. In this place of uncertainty and fear, David has found something that he feels he can control, right? It's his martial prowess. It's his might. He's won a lot of battles. He finds a sword and he's like, this is the best there is. Nobody can stand up to me with this thing. Man, we just kind of wish we got the same enthusiasm for the Lord. You wish you could see that. The Lord who actually gave David all of his victories. The Lord who actually won battles. David's trust isn't fully in the Lord, so he's looking for other things to trust in. And we kind of do that too. It's natural. We look for things to trust in. Oftentimes we make contingency plans and backup plans and whatever else. Like, if I am on a boat, I'm going to trust that the boat is going to keep out water. If I don't totally trust the boat, I'm going to trust that the life jackets work. If I'm on a plane, I trust the pilot to know how to fly the plane. If I don't totally trust the pilot, I trust the people on the ground who are helping the pilot fly. If I don't totally trust that the Cowboys will win the Super Bowl, I can trust that I'll be disappointed. We all place our trust in something, and with some things, it's fine to rely on contingency. Some things, that's okay. But when it comes to God, we know that He's the only trust that needs no contingency. He's the only thing we can put our trust in where we don't need a backup plan. But we make backup plans anyway, don't we? That's the question, where is my trust divided? Where is our trust divided? What part of my life do I not completely trust Him with? My work, my job, my sin, my salvation. Where is your God and? What I mean by that is I have God and, if that doesn't work out, I've got a lot of connections. I've got God and, if that doesn't work out, I've got a pretty good career. I've got God, and if He doesn't help me, I can figure it out. I've got God. And if He's not enough, I'm sure I can fill in the rest. There is a holy God who has never changed, who has never failed. A God that gave a shepherd boy victory over a giant. And a God that has given you victory over sin and death in His Son, and He gives you so many promises. Promises of new life and resurrection in Him. So why isn't that always enough for me? Maybe it's because I don't totally trust. Trust the One who truly prevails. Trust the One who truly prevails. In the midst of fear, David's trust is not fully in the Lord. In the midst of fear, is my trust fully in the Lord? In the middle of my anxieties and my worries, do I give those all to God? Or do I just run? Do I just run away? And the question has to be asked, where are you running to? Verse 10 through 15 says, then David set out and fled that day from Saul, and they went to Achish, king of Gath. But the servants of Achish said to him, is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of this one as they danced, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? David took these words to heart and greatly feared Achish, king of Gath. So he disguised his sanity while in their sight and acted insanely in their custody. And he scribbled on the doors of the gate and drooled on his beard. Then Achish said to his servants, look, you see the man is behaving like an insane person. Why do you bring him to me? Do I lack insane people that you have brought me this one? To behave like an insane person in my presence, shall this one come into my house? Break there. Next we see, run to the only true safety. Run to the only true safety. David, in a bizarre move, decides that the safest place for him to flee is into the land of Israel's mortal enemy. If you've been following along at all in the Samuel series, you will know that the Philistines and the Israelites are really not on good terms. fact, they've been at war for a while now, and they are the mortal enemy of the people of Israel. What's beyond that, David decides to go to Gath. Gath is the hometown of a certain giant that is recently deceased. Beyond that, David goes into Gath, the hometown of Goliath, carrying Goliath's sword. Yeah, he stands out a little bit. This would be like if I drove a Prius to a monster truck rally. Like, everybody would know. The idea is probably that Gath was like the one safe place he could go where Saul couldn't reach him. It was like the one spot where Saul's men couldn't kill him. Gath is like one of the capital cities. It's like right in the middle. Big town, hard to get to. He goes to this guy called Achish. He's also referred to as Abimelech, depending on your translation. Abimelech is like a title, kind of like Pharaoh or Caesar. He's probably hoping that Achish would offer him protection against Saul due to the fact that like him and Saul are mortal enemies. So David's like, look, I'm not a huge fan of this guy right now, and I know you're not a huge fan of him, so we can be friends. David's forgotten something, though. He might have killed their champion. He might have gone out to fight with them every time they came down. He might have just like kind of killed 200 of them not that long ago. The Philistines obviously recognized David. It says, the servants of Achish said to him, is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of this one as they danced, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? Like, yo, you know that guy that was paraded through the streets with like song and dance? Yeah, it's this guy. They recognize him and he's taken captive. It says, David took these words to heart and greatly feared Achish, king of Gath. David tells his third lie. His final deception of the passage. And this one you can sympathize with the most, I think. It says, so he disguised his sanity while in their sight and acted insanely in their custody. And he scribbled on the doors of the gate and drooled on his beard. Couple things. There are a couple details in here that are interesting. Like, one is he drooled on his beard, and you're like, why do I need to know that? The cultural significance is why it's in here. In that time in the East, like having spit in your beard or spitting in somebody else's beard was like mortal offense. It was like big no. If you spit in somebody's beard, like you're dueling to the death. If you have it in your own, it was considered an intolerable disgrace. David is brought low. He's ranting like a madman, drooling on his beard and scribbling on the gate. And it's confusing and kind of shocking. And it should be. Any Hebrew reading this would read it and be like, the Lord's anointed did what? The future king of Israel did what? Even beyond that, this is the Lord's anointed, future king of Israel, and he's doing this, drooling in his beard, scribbling on the gate, in front of the king of the Philistines, Israel's greatest enemy of the time. This is embarrassing. And it should be. David finds himself in the home of his enemy, likely in more danger than he was just running from Saul. We see the mighty warrior brought low. And that sword that just a few verses ago seemed to offer to promise strength, protection. It's pretty useless now. David is left powerless. Despite all his planning and skill, he can't control this outcome. There are enemies on all sides, and there is nothing more that he can do. We see David here come to the end of himself and his might. He ran and ran and ran, and then he found the end of his running. The end of doing things his way. Because eventually, our way kind of always comes to its own end. David is powerless here. He's powerless, can't run anymore. What are we running to? What do I run to? Maybe I know what I'm running from, but where do I go when I'm running? Is it myself? Entertainment? Work? My relationships, my sin? Where do I run to? In that time where I find the end of myself, where my fears catch up to me, when we can't run anymore, and that beautiful broken weakness, there's only one place left to turn. In that state where I'm all out of options, my fears have won. I'm at the end of myself. There's only one place to go. There's one place that is safe to run to, one place where I can put all of my trust. Turn with me to Psalm 34, 1 through 8. A psalm of David when he pretended to be insane before Abimelech, who drove him away and he departed. Says, I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul will make boast in the Lord. The humble will hear it and rejoice. Exalt in the Lord with me. Let's exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he answered me and rescued me from all of my fears. They looked to him and were radiant, and their faces will never be ashamed. This wretched man cried out, and the Lord heard him. Saved him out of all of his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and rescues them. Taste and see that the Lord is good. How blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Run to the one, the only true safety. Flee into the arms of a God that hears your call and answers. Flee to the Savior who has won victory over the world. Go to the Lord who sends his angels to encamp around you. Those that look on him, their faces will never be ashamed. One more, 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 9. It says, and he has said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weakness so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I delight in weakness, in insults, in distresses, persecutions, in difficulties, on behalf of Christ. For when I am weak, then I am strong. When we are weak, Christ is strong. When you are in distress, Christ is your safety. When you endure difficulties, Christ provides a way. When you're afraid, Christ is where you can run. Christ is the only place to run. Brothers and sisters, we have fears. We have worries. I have worries. Our trust, my trust, is easily divided. There are so many things that we run from. Don't you want safety? Don't you want deliverance? Don't you want rest? Don't you want peace? Run to Him. Fall into His arms and trust. Look at what He has done and remember the victories that He has won for you. He's the one place that's worth it. We see David's deception miraculously somehow works. He's let go. Chapter 22, verse 1. So David departed from there. How does that work? You show up to this place, like the heart of your enemies, all these guys recognize you right away, and they just let you go? Yeah, well, it's pretty clear who David credits for that. It's pretty evident who David thinks the victory belongs to. He says, I sought the Lord. Psalm 34. This is the psalm that was written by David about those events. It's unclear if he wrote it while he was there or after. Regardless, it's obvious what he was thinking of. So I sought the Lord and He answered me. He rescued me from my fears. Verse 6, he says, this wretched man cried out and the Lord heard him and saved him out of his troubles. David finally stops running and just turns to God. He provides a way for his servant. It's a miracle David survived. Guess what? God provides a way of deliverance. He provides deliverance for David. He provides a way for you. God has delivered you. From sin, from fear, from death. It's up to us to trust Him with that. It's up to us to run to Him. Taste and see that the Lord is good. How blessed is the man who takes refuge in Him. Stand with me, let's pray.